Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the first of the Distinguished Innovator Lecture Series of the Speaker Series. It's really my pleasure to have Adam Bosworth here as your first speaker. He is a very distinguished innovator and entrepreneur. I'll just give you a quick list of some of the things that he has been instrumental in the development of. One of them is Google Health. One of them is Microsoft Access. One of them is Internet Explorer. Another one is BEA's WebLogic. He's been Vice President of Engineering, and he's helped work on Google Calendar and Google Spreadsheet. He's the Chief Software Architect at BEA. He's founded a few companies. One of them is CrossGain, and he's a pioneer in the development of XML. So that's a excellent background. So in 2008, he started something new again, and that is Keyus, which I'm no doubt he's going to describe today. And Keyus is something that comes out of his own personal interest to take on issues in healthcare. So with that, we're very pleased to have Adam as our first speaker for 2010 in this series. Thanks.
Thank you for the kind introduction. Whenever you hear the word distinguished and you're my age, you can feel the gray hairs that are creeping up all around you. And in desperate defense, I'll say that I wasn't sure I'd make this talk last night because my wife and I are expecting a baby. And it looked last night like it might have been last night, but it wasn't, so here I am. If I had to pick one word for what's helped me invent things, it's, I could pick two. One would be stupidity and the other would be dyslexia. So I am dyslexic. It's not really severe, but I learned to think early on in terms of patterns. You know, I learned to first draw pictures and get my head around an idea using pictures and only then go back and read the material behind the picture. And to this day, I like to look for simple solutions to hard problems. You could call it stupidity, you could call it laziness, you could call it whatever you want. But fundamentally, when I'm building things, if I see something that looks hard, I usually stop and say, is there a simpler way to do this? And what I wanted to talk about today was the second part of what's hard. Frankly, coming up with an idea is not all by itself that hard. Making the idea successful is brutal most of the time. There was this very famous quote, I don't really know if Einstein said it, about genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, but I think he underestimated the perspiration side. So I want to talk a little bit about what makes it hard to invent things, and I want to use Keyus as an object lesson since it's sitting right there. The idea behind Keyus was a simple one. And I'm going to spend a few minutes, not a lot, walking through why we wanted to do Keyus. But succinctly put, we spend $2.4 trillion a year in this country a year on healthcare. That is way more than the bailout. We are on track to spend $3.4 trillion a year within a decade. That is like adding a bailout every year. And that's not, we're spending $3.4 trillion over the decade. We are on track to spend $3.4 trillion a year by the end of the within a decade. And that's a lot of money. We can't really afford it. We're losing our competitive edge, and we're not even getting very good quality service for it. Our outcomes suck. So I took a hard look at this when I was at Google doing Google Health, and it was pretty obvious why. It wasn't as complicated as you would think, and everyone will tell you how it's really complicated, and there are structural problems, and there are all these structural issues, and there are. It's the craziest, most broken system of healthcare you've ever seen, because we, the consumer, don't pay. When a consumer pays for something, they pay for value in some way, shape, or form. It may not be value as, you know, someone else might see it, but they think they're getting value for money. And ultimately, products that deliver more value tend to beat products that deliver less value. That's not true at all in healthcare, because you don't pay for healthcare. So when you're going to have your doctor treat you, you know, you're just as happy to have the MRI as the ACE bandage. In fact, maybe happier. Who knows? Maybe there's something they'll find in the MRI. But the MRI is $3,000 and the ACE bandage is $30 and probably more effective. And in fact, the MRI radiation can add up. So we have absolutely no incentive to do the right thing. So that was the problem that I was looking at. Now, what I want to talk about today isn't the problem. I'm going to go through the problem so you understand it. But I want to talk about the difference between inventing a product and then making it successful. Because this is one of the key challenges that anyone who's trying to do any startup is going to run into. The VCs make this really easy. They have what's called Series A and Series B. Series A is when you come up to them, and these days you have to have sort of a credible background of some sort or a reasonably good working prototype, and say, I have a dream, and this dream should be able to make money. And the VCs won't really believe you. They will demand an extremely detailed spreadsheet, which they will know is worth less than nothing, and you will know is worth less than nothing, and none of us have ever figured out why we go through this. But and in fact, my VCs didn't. They just laughed and said, we don't need that. But fundamentally, they're betting on two things. John Doerr, in an inadvertently prescient talk about Navigenics, said, when you're doing Series A, you're worrying about two things. Is it the right team, and is it can they build the product they say they're going to build? Most startups fail right there. Most startups fail because it's not the right team. If you don't have the right people, sooner or later, the company has a very high risk of self-destructing, even if you do have the right product. And it is very hard to build the right product with the wrong people, because they fight all the time. Startups are inherently stressful. You need people who deal well with stress. And you need people who have a shared, common vision. There's this truism in entrepreneurism called the elevator pitch. And the elevator pitch actually matters much more than you'd think. Being able to have a single succinct sentence where you describe what are you building and why would people want this in a way that you could explain to your mom is key. If you can't, your odds are greatly diminished and you're going to be successful. Because you can't line up everyone in the company. They don't know of how they're running the same direction. You can't make the right priority decisions. But as John Doerr inadvertently and presciently pointed out, even if you do have the right people, and even if they do build the product they set out to build, you encounter a new risk. The new risk is called marketing risk. And the marketing risk is that you can't sell it. It is very easy to build a product that people like, but they won't pay you for. And Kias is a great example when we started it. Technically speaking, Facebook, for a very long time, was an example. There's probably no one in this room who's not on Facebook. But probably not one of you has actually paid Facebook. Some of you might have clicked on some things in Facebook, but they're actually earning surprisingly little money per user. I mean, by way of thinking about it, Google earns about, $10 per year per user. And Microsoft actually has always tried to earn about $30 per year per user. And Facebook does not even earn, $1, or actually it does, but it's just now sort of passing the $1 to $2 per year per user. The real challenge comes along with what's called Series B. Series B is when you go out and try and sell your product and you discover that it's not going to go according to plan. And that's the point of this talk, is to talk about what happens and what do you do. So as I said, when we started Kias, we were starting with a very simple idea. We were noticing, first of all, we call this thing a healthcare system, but actually no one in the healthcare system, or almost no one, is paid to keep you healthy. In fact, they're paid for you to be sick. A bunch of hospitals have tried to do good preventative care where they go and they take people they've just treated for heart attacks and they basically teach them how to eat properly and work out properly and take their meds properly, at which point the people never come back and the hospitals end up with empty beds and their boards tell them to stop doing that. They're actually paid for you to be sick. We actually are working with some people right now who are rolling out care plans to hospitals using Kias. And they're working on something called 90-day readmissions. And there's occasionally a warden joke that it's perfect if it keeps the patient away for 91 days, but not for 900 days. Because the system is rewarding right now treatment of illness. It's not rewarding avoiding illness. Not a single doctor gets paid more money if they keep you from being sick than if you get sick. Then almost all of them get paid more money if you are sick, which is kind of a problem. It's not what you would really want. It has had some interesting implications. There's articles recently that have been coming out about the amount of people in this country who are unhealthy. You've probably noticed them. The number of people in this country who are overweight is stunning. It's called politely the metabolic syndrome because typically it goes along with overweight as high blood pressure and high cholesterol and what have you. The effects, which are typically generated by this, are pretty interesting. They tend to kill you. These are the prevalence of the metabolic syndrome by age, and this is what happens. This is cardiovascular disease. Or put differently, a lot more people die than would be dying otherwise. In fact, if you look at where the deaths come from in this country and where the money goes in this country, it is primarily due to lifestyle-related diseases. You know, we tend to think of illness as bad luck. We were struck by lightning. There's nothing we could have done. But most illness and most costs are not like that. They're related to bad choices. We're perpetuating this in a rather scary way. There was an article in the New York Times this morning about, or maybe it was yesterday, about pregnancies and overweight moms, and the fact that the overweight moms are generating overweight kids. And the overweight kids now have a high disposition to be overweight, and they've started to generate more overweight kids. And in fact, this is a self-reinforcing and steadily increasing spiral of overweight. And this is leading to a much, much younger onset of juvenile diabetes, and diabetes type 2, and all of the other diseases that go with it. Since I am having a baby, or at least my wife is, we've been talking to the obstetrician. It's pretty interesting. She says, back when she started, pretty much every baby was born in around 7 pounds, and they were pretty straightforward births. It turns out a 7-pound baby can fit pretty easily through the pelvic canal. Now most of the babies are coming in around 8.5 to 9 pounds. They're all hard. She said they now have a full-time night staff of several doctors, where they used to have one resident because of the number of challenging births, mostly due to large overweight babies. And that doesn't count the problems the kids have. You might think that this system was working great for the doctors. I've just described what a terrible system we have for the patients. You think, oh, well, at least that's where the doctors are making it like bandits. Well, the people you and I think about as doctors are doing terribly. The people you and I think about as doctors are our primary care physicians or interns. Actually, you're too young. You may not be thinking about that. But if you had a doctor, you would be thinking about them that way. Here's an interesting statistic. Pretty much everyone spends more money on their barber than the doctor gets paid for seeing you each year, which is pretty impressive if you think about it. You know, it's not that I don't like haircuts. It's just that, you know, one is, does your hair look okay? And the other one is, are you actually being healthy and staying alive? The average doctor earns less than $100 per patient per year. And the only way to deal with this is they've been jammed to see more and more patients. Well, the only way they can see more and more patients is have fewer and fewer minutes. If they only have fewer and fewer minutes, something has to give. And what gives is any useful advice to you about what you should be doing, because there's just no time left. And that's pretty much what's happened in our system. One thing that when I put this slide up, which was about 2 years ago, I got all this angry mail from all these people saying that cannot be true. And this slide said that we pay less than 1% of our healthcare budget to primary care docs. And everyone said, there's no way. So I said, okay, we've got 130,000 doctors. Is that wrong? And each one of them nets. And this is after they've paid Medicare fees and they've paid the malpractice insurance fees. But this is gross to them. This is not, they have to pay taxes on this. So this is still income they pay taxes on. Gets $150,000 on average, and that's actually high, by the way. If you do the math, that's $19.5 billion. Where am I wrong? And it's 2 years, and no one has yet come back with a single explanation of where their numbers are wrong. In fact, there's been a fair number of, oh, maybe that's right. Well, that's a pretty stupid system. A system where the people who actually are on the front line taking care of people, getting less than 1% of a $2.4 trillion a year expense. That's $2,400 billion a year. And that's a system where 1% difference is $24 billion. You know, this, you talk about entrepreneurial opportunities. Think about that. I'm sure some of you here, how many here are involved in alternative energy in one way or another, or translational medicine in one way or another? Peanuts. Peanuts compared to what we're talking about. So the idea behind KIAS was this is a bad thing. You know, we can't afford to wait for the system. We can't afford for all these people to die. And yet it was avoidable. We could, by and large, get rid of 80% of the heart disease cases, 80% of the diabetes type 2 cases, which lead to enormous expense. One of the great things about modern medicine is we can keep you alive longer, which is a good thing. But we keep you alive longer, often at an annual cost of $50,000 to $80,000 a year. So if you live 15 years and you're costing $50,000 a year, someone is busy paying the money, and if you can do the math. Your expected cost just blew through $1 million, and it turns out that's why we're spending so much money. I listed three main diseases, but pretty much everything I just listed here is lifestyle related. Almost all of these things not only cost a lot of money, there's another cost. It's not a trivial cost. It's called productivity. Let's say that the average worker in this country, and they don't, but let's say that they earn, just to keep life really simple, $50,000 a year, and they work 200 days a year, right? If they miss 5 days, you know, you can do the math. The cost to the company is very significant of that lost labor. Most of them are missing 5 days due to one of these things. Many of them are missing 15 or 20 days, and some are missing 40 or 50 due to these issues. And mostly it's because they don't have the tools to stay healthy. So the vision, the dream, and this is what powers every startup when you do a startup, the dream was to turn this around. The dream was to basically take all this data that we're having about people and do essentially for healthcare what Mint.com did for finance. Now, I suspect most of you are actually still too young to have used Mint. How many people here have used Mint.com? One of you, why are you using it? And why do you care? Why is it good that your information is consolidated? And how has this helped you? Okay, so you are definitely a Berkeley student. Most people who use Mint.com are not as smart. And they're using Mint.com for a much simpler reason. It's giving them the reminders they need to pay their darn bills or notice that their bank accounts are getting low. It's acting like a little cop looking over their shoulder and noticing when they're about to get in trouble and saying, hey, you need to do this. And otherwise, they forget. They're busy, they have lives, they're trying to have kids. You know, whatever it is, they forget and they get overwhelmed. There was a company before Mint.com that did exactly what you said, except for the planning part, which is important. It was called Yodlee, and it actually pulled all your data together and nobody came. And then Mint.com came along and they did two things. They provided a model where they gave you all the reminders you needed to essentially not do bad things. And they gave you, just like you said, a planning tool where if you wanted, you could figure out what should you be doing, put together a plan, and then they give you the tools to sort of follow that plan, right? And that's a good thing. We want to do the same thing for healthcare. We wanted to start by giving people all the reminders they needed to at least not get sicker. You know, don't forget your vaccinations, don't forget to show up for the optometrist, the podiatrist, don't forget to take your meds, etc. And then, by the way, if you want to figure out whether you're in good health and if you're not, what to do, get better, here's how to put together a plan. So that was the original vision behind the company. There was one thing that was working in our favor. The thing that was working in our favor, succinctly put, are these things. You know, we now have a model where people can start to collect data really easily on the go. Wearable devices talk to these things. Glucometers talk to these things. Blood pressure meters talk to these things. So all of a sudden, without you having to type data in, a lot of data could start to flow. The doctors have absolutely no idea what to do with this data. In fact, the one thing I will tell you from Google Health that became stunningly clear the moment we built connectivity to hospitals is they were willing to push data at us, even though they swore they never would. They were never willing to take data back, because they didn't know how to handle it. Their EMRs are to modern technology what dinosaurs are to, you know, I don't know, modern cars. I mean, they are pathetically out of date. And so the average hospital has no idea what data about any data about you. 85% of hospitals know nothing about you. You go in, you have all those instruments, they're wired up to you, they test you, gone. Absolutely no record. They have no idea what happened to you. Of the 15% that use electronic medical records, none of them can take data from you about what's going on in your life the rest of the time when you're not in the hospital. So we have this data, it's called, but they don't know what to do with it. So the idea was we'd give them something to do with it. And what we'd basically do is we'd help them do the things they needed to do to get healthier. And the things to do, and the consumers want this. I mean, one of the interesting things I also saw when I was at Google, and we've seen ever since, health is a very big search category. If you look at sort of what do people do in query, I mean, obviously, you know, meeting people is bigger, buying certain things is bigger, but health is way up there. Because you know what? If you're sick or if you're given a new med, you're curious. You'd like to know, it's no fun being sick. And so consumers have very quickly decided, since the doctors have no time for them and won't talk to them, they might as well go learn on the web. So they do go and learn on the web. So the idea, the vision behind the company is we'd start by giving everyone exactly what you said over there. We'd give them a personal health record as opposed to a personal financial record. It would pull all their data together, all their data, all the data daily as well as all the data coming from the hospitals. But it would then use that data to give them the reminders they needed to be healthy and give them the advice they needed. It would start giving them the weekly advice. It was, if they were on meds, it would remind them if they wanted to, and they weren't taking their meds, to take their meds. If they needed to walk, most Americans don't walk enough. You're lucky to be on a campus. If they needed to walk at least 30 minutes, at least four times a week, to remind them to do that, et cetera. So the idea was we would build that. We would effectively have this prescribed to them by doctors, and that part is actually working surprisingly well, and we built it. And then, and this is where the talk gets interesting, we went out to launch it last October, and we ran into reality. So this is going to happen to everyone in this room who actually starts something. If you go and you start a company, you have a good idea, you go and build it, hopefully you build the first version yourself and you try and make your friends use it and listen to them before you go any further or raise any money, you're going to run into three issues. And one of them is, whatever your business models turns out to be, it is very unlikely to be what you thought it was. I've been advising I don't know how many startups in my life on what, on how to do business, and the one thing I have seen is the ones that made money almost invariably didn't know what they were, how they were going to make money when they started. Little companies like Google, for example, or perhaps another little company like Microsoft, which started by making something called BASIC. Oh yeah, we all buy BASIC. But they did figure it out. It just turned out it wasn't BASIC. So issue number one was the business model was flawed. This is okay. Basically, venture capitalists expect this. When you do a startup, there is it's well understood you're going to hit a point where you try and sell the product, and it's going to be harder to sell than you thought. And you're not going to necessarily be able to sell the people you thought. The second issue is the product itself. Almost invariably, when a product first comes out the door, it's not perfect. Why isn't it perfect? Because we as humans aren't perfect. And since we're not perfect, we don't do a very good job designing the products. We can't think of everything people will really want. There's only one way to find out how to make a product perfect. Get customers to use it and listen to them intensely. And then respond rapidly. That is the basic secret to building a good product. Ship fast, ship frequently, listen hard. The rest of this is noise. So, and the reason for that is because, as I said, in the old days when software was built, there was a thing called the waterfall model. It should have been called the I'm putting my head in the sand model. And the waterfall model was that you sat down with a bunch of people called systems analysts, which have told you everything right there. And they would go and design the product for about 6 months, and they would end up with a spec like this. And then they would hand the spec off to a bunch of programmers who would go and code it for maybe a year. And then they would hand it off to a group of QA, and then about 2 years later, they would discover that the product didn't work at all, and then they would start all over again. Really, I'm not making this up. This is how most software was built for a long time. It was really hard to argue against it. It's a terrible, terrible idea. We build cars this way today. A really good idea is to get something out and listen and improve it in 3 weeks, and get something out and then listen and improve it in 3 weeks, and so on. There's two strategies for this. It's called agile development in the software business world, and I'm going to describe it as the Mark Zuckerberg strategy and the not Mark Zuckerberg strategy. So the Mark Zuckerberg strategy, as practiced at Facebook, is every 2 or 3 weeks you just rethink everything. You build whatever you built for that sprint, and then you stop and say, okay, what are our priorities this 3 weeks? No preconceptions based on where we were last time. Let's just figure it out now anew, and then go and build again, and so on. It's a great model when you're winning. It really is, because you're just constantly dealing with the latest version of reality. It is not a good model when there are a lot of big things you need to do you haven't done that require sustained effort, because it tends to create sort of the corporate version of attention deficit disorder. You work on it for a sprint, and you forget about it for 6 sprints. Then you work on it again for a sprint of 3 weeks, and you forget about it for 6 sprints. And meanwhile, you're not making much progress on something that needs constant attention. So the other model, I'll call it the Salesforce Mark Benioff model, is you put together a roadmap, but you still do it in 3-week chunks, and you do constantly tune it. But you have some sense of where you're trying to go quarter to quarter. Either one works, depending on where you are. Typically, one works better if you're essentially just improving an existing product that's already dominant. The other one works better when you're trying to break into a market. The third issue is users. I used to draw this picture when I was at Microsoft. And I would draw this picture where the y-axis was where the user was, and the x-axis was time. So just imagine the further out to the right you go on the x-axis, the more time has passed. And I would draw a little circle of where you thought the user was at the time you started your product. And I would draw a picture not too far away from it, but not there, of where the user really was. And then I would have a straight line going out from you to where the user, where long past where the user was, to when you actually shipped. And meanwhile, I would show the user steadily veering away from this point. So by the time you shipped, the user was nowhere near your product. That is very typical. And in fact, that happened to Kias in an interesting way. We started working on the product in 2008. I think that's right. No, really 2009. We built it. We launched it in October. And by the time we did, something very fundamental happened. It was called these. Most people had decided if they were ever going to put in data that in any way was transitory or daily, they were going to do it over their mobile phone. You know, they would go to the web when they actually needed to go to the web, but the web was not the primary mechanism of collecting what was going on a daily basis. And that affected us. So let me just walk through these in a little more detail. Business model. So the original vision behind Kias was that we would be paid a lot like an app store. The App Store, many of us fell in love with the App Store because it was so nice. You know, what a great idea. Everyone will build apps. You collect your 30%. That's what Apple collects. They get 70%, so they don't whine too much. And you're getting paid all this money for other people's work. It's wonderful if you're an entrepreneur. It was not to be. Consumers are not really excited about about paying for health apps. And if they're not excited about paying, the people who build health apps are not excited about building them. There's a priming the pump problem there, and it didn't prime. It turned out that the real business model was nothing to do with B2C. And this is one of the, again, the very common things you run into in many, many startups. The real business model was B2B. Now, you're going to hear this term, and your eyes are going to glaze over, and you're going, what is B2B and what is B2C? It's actually very fundamental. B2C is a wonderful place when you can be there because you are selling direct to the consumer. And particularly if you're building a website kind of thing, you do not really need salespeople. Let me repeat that. In a normal environment, when you're building anything that's sort of web-based and you're selling to consumers, you don't need salespeople. You just try to improve your product. They come, they pay you, and you're happy. You need product people. You need marketing people to tell all these consumers that your product is there. But you actually don't need salespeople. Salespeople are expensive. They require lots of care and feeding, and they can only sell to so many people. In a B2B space, you must have salespeople. In fact, it's not at all clear you need marketing. In a B2B space, they don't really care what the press is saying about you. It gives you a sort of cachet and maybe a brand. I get, the other day, for some reason that frankly completely eludes me, Time Magazine gave Kias one of the top 50 websites. Not sure why they did that. They didn't talk to us. But we had this huge spike in traffic, which earned us not a penny. It gave us a little cachet on the B2B sales, but it wasn't really very exciting. And so there was a big, oh, that's nice, Kias, and everyone went back to work. On B2B, you are selling to people who have to pay you real checks. When you sell B2C, you're not usually charging too much money. Everyone here know what elasticity of demand is? Or does anyone here not know what elasticity of demand is? Okay, so for the one person honest enough to raise his hand, elasticity of demand is the idea that as you lower price, more people will buy the goods, and that if the more people grows faster than the price goes down, it might be a good idea to lower price. For example, if 10 people would pay you $100, but a million people would pay you $1, you could just charge $1. Sometimes it works the other way around. 10 people will pay you $100,000, a million people will pay you a penny. At that point, you're actually better off charging $100. So you have to sort of figure this out. But typically speaking, B2B sales are not cheap. They are not a penny, and there's a very simple reason. It's those pesky salespeople. It turns out you really can't afford to have a sales force selling a product direct to consumers, I mean to businesses, unless you're getting paid, oh, say, at least $100,000 a sale, arguably more. So that means your price point is pretty well fixed. You better be building something that businesses are willing to pay you at least $100,000, if not more. Or you better be doing telemarketing sales and hoping that you can sell through, which is the Salesforce model. Now, interestingly, even Google's business model turns out not to be B2C. Does anyone know what Google's business model really is?
Advertising.
And who do they sell to?
People who want to sell stuff.
Well, they don't actually sell to people who want to sell stuff. There are actually no salespeople, pretty much, at Google who sell to people who want to sell stuff. They sell to advertising companies. They sell to the people who sell to people who want to sell stuff. It's an important distinction. That means they're very B2B. They have a very large sales force, and they're very good. And their job is to go out and find people who are basically the people who people who want to sell stuff go to and convince them to use Google. It's not hard because the economics are pretty good. But nonetheless, that is the basic model. At least when I left Google a few years ago, there was virtually no one at Google that was actually selling to anything you would recognize as a company other than ad companies. But they were selling to lots and lots of ad companies. Now, Google was in a nice position because they got a lot of money where they didn't sell to anybody, where people just put their own websites up and put their own AdWords up. But a lot, to the extent that they had a sales force, it was B2B. So in our business, in Kias, since we're in health, the ultimate purchasers were the people who pay for health care. Now, most of you probably think that the people who pay for health care are insurers. By and large, that is not true. The insurers are crafty devils, and they figured out that they were not very good at predicting how much health care would cost, but they were very good at getting paid for administering health care, figuring out what benefits you're entitled to, which doctors can treat you, which meds you can have, what procedures you can have, and what to pay the doctors for it. So most business for most insurers in this country is actually acting as an administrator for big companies and not taking the risk. The risk is actually taken by the companies that pay them. And for example, every single company in the Fortune 500 is self-insured. So when you think about that $2.4 trillion, a huge chunk of that is being paid directly by employers. And in fact, they're sort of paying twice. They pay fees to these insurers just to do the administrative tasks, pretty hefty fees. And then on top of that, they pay for their employees when they get sick. Governments are pretty much in the same boat. The VA, Medicare, pretty much in the same boat. The only people that the insurers really are taking on the risk for are sort of mid-level employers and individuals. And as you've all seen in widely publicized cases, they do their very best not to take on individuals. And when they do, they charge so much that they couldn't lose. Then the individuals retaliate by not buying the insurance unless they're so sick that they could lose, and there's this interesting arms race. Mostly, though, it's employers and governments, to some degree health plans. The problem is, if you're a little startup and you had to go sell to these people and you had to go and build a sales force, you would go broke. You would go broke because you would have to hire a whole sales force of people. All of them are selling one-on-one with what's called latency. And latency is how long it takes you to make a sale. When you're trying to sell a product to keep employees healthier, I'm here to tell you it takes you 6 months to make the sale and 6 more months to get paid. And that means that you've just spent whatever you paid that sales force guy a year before any money even started to come in. Small companies can't afford to do this. So what Kias did, and was we got completely lucky, and most startups that survive do get lucky, is we found channel partners. And I'll come back to that. The second problem we had was that the product wasn't good enough. And again, virtually all of you, if you build a successful product, will find out that your product is not good enough. Now, being good enough is not about features. Steve has done a really brilliant job proving this over and over again, but perhaps the best example is the Flip video, which does a really good job having fewer features. Being good enough is not about having more features. I emphasize this because some number of you, feel free to raise your hands, are MBAs. Now, I love MBAs like a brother or sister, but that's not totally true, but I'll come back to that later. But back when I was a younger engineer building a spreadsheet, a very smart, I guess, Harvard MBA came in to work with me. He was sent in to work with me, and he produced the checkbox from hell, as I described it. He took a look at every and any feature that could be itemized to my competitor, and he wrote this very long list. It must have been 42 feet long of checkboxes they had, and showed all the holes where I didn't have checks, and said, "You have to fill in those checks." And I said, "Rob, no one uses those checks. They don't work well. They're not useful. We're not doing those checks." And we had a big debate. Now, as it turned out, I ran the engineering. It's very hard to beat the guy who's running the engineering in an engineering company. And so we didn't do those checks, and the product did really well. But it would have slowed me down for a year. I would have lost my competitive advantage. I wouldn't have gone out in time. It's not about features. It is about what do consumers want that you're not giving them. And to do that, you have to ask them. And you have to be a good listener. I have a brilliant woman working for me as director of business development. She's smarter than I am. God knows she's more organized than I am. She's certainly more personable than I am. She has a great job lining up these channel partners for me. The one thing she's not always good at is listening. She's a great salesperson. She can communicate to them how good Kias is. But when I then want to know what's wrong with what we're doing, I send someone else in. And you do. Years and years ago, when I was at Microsoft, I built, and this is a good example of what was wrong, I built something called Internet Explorer 4.0, and I went on the road to talk to people about what was wrong. And as you can imagine, I got an earful about what was wrong. And that was key. I spent a month just talking to customers, and what I told the sales forces, line me up with the ones who are most unhappy. You learn way more from talking to unhappy customers than happy customers. In fact, you learn almost nothing from talking to happy customers. There's no percentage in talking to happy customers. You could be talking to unhappy customers at the same time, and you'll be improving your product much faster. If you're talking to happy customers, it's because you have an ego problem and you need to be soothed. And then you should not be doing a startup. It turned out that there were four things fundamentally wrong with the way we built Kias when we launched in October. Number one was something called perceived personalization. Kias had a very good advertising line that we came up sort of by accident, which said, the best medical minds give you personal advice. Now, everyone knew why they would want the best medical minds to give them personal advice, because they, God knows, they weren't getting it from their doctors. And so everyone came along and went to Kias and signed up saying, I want the best personal advice. Unfortunately, what they got felt to them like a WebMD page being pushed at them each week. Now, in fact, there was a very smart set of rules that were figuring out which WebMD page made the most sense for them each week. But it didn't feel like that. It did not feel like personalized advice. It was very important that it felt personal, that it was perceived to be personal. Imagine you get two pages. One says, Adam, you've gained 10 pounds since you started Kias. This has raised you from the mildly overweight to the dangerously close to obese stage. This increases your risk of a heart attack by 20%. You have a kid that you would like to grow up and see get old, do better. The other one says people with a BMI over 27 have a higher risk of heart attacks than people without a BMI. Which one's more compelling? People wanted the personalized content. The second issue was personalized choice. The care plans were a little didactic. What the care plans do, and they're really just big rules engines that doctors write for Kias with good content people, is they would wake up every day and they go, what should I tell you today? What's on your to-do list? Okay, this is a to-do for you. No one's ever actually been able to have a communication with a Strasbourg goose that make foie gras about whether they really like being force-fed, but I'm pretty sure that if you could talk to the geese, they would be against it. People don't like being told what to do. It's a basic rule of thumb. As someone about to have a kid, but I have two older ones, I can tell you what applies to kids applies to everyone else. If you want a kid to do something, you don't say, do this. You say, here are three things you could do, where all three would be vastly better than what they're doing right now. And they'll pick one, and they'll perceive it as their choice, and they're more likely to do it. Well, it turns out that exactly the same thing is true in healthcare. Occasionally, you have to say, do this. If someone comes into Kias and they report that their blood pressure is 155 over 110 and they're pregnant, it behooves the rules engine to say, talk to your doctor now. Your health and the risk of your baby are at severe risk. You probably have something called eclampsia. However, if it says, would you like to practice eating some things and doing some exercises and yoga poses that would help you when your delivery time comes and to have a healthier baby, you should sign up for those things. You should not be told these are your to-dos. We were telling you this is your to-do. Went over like a lead balloon. Mobile support. I'm going to come back to this. But fundamentally, people had, and we really underestimated this when we built Kias, people had a great desire to build what I'm going to call health diaries. A health diary is when you're just reporting every day. I guess it's typically people who have issues. But every day, what's wrong with them from a health point of view? Mood. Diet, what are they eating, what are they exercising, how do they feel, where is the pain? They wanted to build health diaries. The only thing is, when you want to build health diaries, you don't want to be going to the web every day. You want to be using this. Not necessarily a smartphone. Even as we speak, and this is Berkeley, so it's heretical to say this, most people don't have smartphones. Everybody has text. So you start with text. You support text reminders and text input. The very first thing we built into Kias after we realized our mistake was support for two-way texting and making it really easy for the people who built these plans to support two-way texting. And then we started working, okay, let's get the iPhone out. We built mail out because mail was really easy. Now, you can do the perceived personalization, the perceived choice. You can do the social, the mobile, and we had two very big problems, and they had to do with the other half of the equation. And this shows that nerds built Kias. Nerds are not always good at thinking about why would people want to use the product. Some of you may be nerds. If so, find someone who is very good at thinking about why would someone want to use the product. Because what makes people want to use it is one of two things, by and large. And it's not, oh, I'm going to be healthy in 20 years. People's time frame for being, oh, I'm going to be healthy in 20 years is about zero. It's either I have some very quick goal because I think I'm going to either, the pain will go away or I'm going to be more dateable. Or one of two things, social support and rewards. How many people here use Farmville? That is spooky. Farmville on Facebook. That is quite amazing. I think statistically, okay, I better finish up. I'm being waved at. Normally, that half the room would go up. People love to get little rewards for doing the right thing. And so fundamentally, we built a reward model and a social support model. No, there's something very odd about this. I mean, like if you do the black marbles and white marbles thing, there's no way that you could get this many people to be black marbles. I think there's a certain amount of just disingenuousness. So I want to wrap up by talking about how did we at Kias make the bridge? How did we go from basically being a B2C company with the wrong product to being a company that now is actually doing okay, selling to B2B? And it's something you're going to need to do. Number one, we listened. There is no substitute for going back to those unhappy customers and listening. Number two, we did not have preconceptions about the business model. It's great to have preconceptions when you're building the company. They don't do any harm. They're a happy fantasy. You all are convinced you're going to get rich. It's motivating. You work those extra hours. Just when you finally get to reality and start selling, then you have to not have the preconceptions. Number three, we looked for deals where everyone won, where we made money if they made money, and they made money if we made money. It is much easier for your salespeople to cut a deal like that. In fact, if you find any deal not like that, something is wrong, and you will probably ultimately not make money, at least in the B2B space. We also had to learn, and this we learned the hard way, what are called false positives. We would walk into hospital after hospital, and they would basically do the wave. I had the head of one of the biggest hospitals in the country with tears in his eyes telling me how great Kias was and how he would put every patient on it, and I have yet to receive a single dollar from these tears. We realized that the hospitals loved Kias, but they couldn't pay us. It is not good to have someone who loves you and can't pay you if you're a startup, unless someone else will pay you. You have to admit that you're wrong. And you also have to think about leverage. You can only afford to sell to so many people. You can only afford to support so many people. This is a very, very hard thing for startups to do. This is the need to say no. We would fail at Kias if it weren't for my partner. My co-founder is a very tough Northern Italian. He's very good at saying no. And over, I go, George, it'll be a great deal. Okay, Adam, we have no one to support this. We have no one to handhold them. It is going to cause it. We are going to fail. And we walk. It's very important you can do this. For the product, we have a very simple strategy at Kias. We call it bet on the kids. If you're over 30, and this is politically incorrect, and if I'm being taped, I'll deny I ever said this, we probably aren't asking you to tell us what you want in the product. We fundamentally have hired a bunch of people who are very creative. They think out of the box. They are completely irreverent. They don't care what George or I think. And they tend to be the ones who are actually thinking intelligently about what needs to go in the product. And so we listen to them. We give them a lot of room to run. And then we wait with interest to see how many of their ideas are right. We don't assume it's 100%. We just look for a certain percentage. So we do a lot of betting on the kids. We do get supporting data. They do a lot of research to support their hunches. We iterate a lot with potential customers. The B2B customers have already done a lot of their own betting on the kids, and they talk to us about it. We do agile development. And then on the agile development, and this is something that was interesting. When I joined Google, they had the 70-30 rule. I thought, that's the silliest thing I ever heard. Why do you have a 70-30 rule? And their 70-30 rule was 70% of the people should work on ads and search, and only 30% should work on everything else. And apparently Sergey had done something one day with partial differential equations on the board in front of everyone where he proved that this should be 70-30, and no one really believed the math, but they were too awe-inspired to say so in the face of all these partial differential equations. We did not do partial differential equations. We did, this feels about right. About 2/3 of our work should be coming from specific requests from customers who pay us, and about 1/3 should be coming from us betting on the kids about what they think we need to do that we're not doing. It's a very simple algorithm. Lastly, and this is interesting, the New York Times had an article today about high tech. And they pointed out that while high tech is recovering and the job market is recovering, the high tech industry is recovering, the job market in high tech is not recovering. We're no different. I never thought we would be offshore. Our entire iPhone thing is offshore. It's all in China. Why? Because really good engineers working really hard for us there with a really excellent work ethic are getting paid about $10,000 a year and are charging us about $25,000 a year. And the same engineers here would charge us fully burdened about $100,000 a year. It's almost impossible for a startup to avoid that logic. It's very scary. And I'm not the only one I know. Virtually everyone I know who's building mobile apps is moving offshore for the mobile app creation. So finally, if you're going to do this and you're going to be an entrepreneur, you will go through two phases. I got asked a good question. I got told, so why do you have people here if you can offshore? What's the difference? Now, I would like to tell you that it was obvious, and I would like to tell you that there was all this special stuff that we could only do here, and the stuff that wasn't special we do over there. Unfortunately, I would be lying. It is not at all clear to us that outside of sales and support, there is anything different between the work that's being done for us offshore and the work that we're doing here, except price. The secret was and is finding someone offshore who you trust, who understands how to do product design and understands how to run engineering. But if you find one person offshore who you trust, and they're hiring a bunch of engineers and managing them, and you know that you trust this person, you know that they know what they're doing, they can undercut the price here by a whole lot. And it's a very interesting phenomenon looking forward. The internet has made it possible to build apps remotely. Can I now move on for a second? So bottom line, you're going to go through two phases. The first phase is stick to your plan. There is no point in shifting from your plan until you have a product in people's hands, and every point not to. Don't spend too much time looking at your competitors. Don't spend too much time on analysis. Get a product out there and stick to your vision until that product is out there. I have seen more startups fail by what I'll call vacillating. They do this. New company comes out like that, they move there. New company comes out like that, they go there. New company comes out like that, they go there. They never ship. Or if they do ship, the product is all over the map and awful. Don't do that. While you're getting a product out the door, stick to that elevator pitch and be as monomaniacal, obsessive, and generally intolerant of other people's opinions as possible. Because it's not going to help you. Until you have a product, you have no data. And it will almost certainly make your product worse and cost you money and take longer. Hire people who are fearless. Startups are scary. You do not know if it's going to work. If they are timorous people, if they're going, how am I going to have job security? They really, really, really do not belong in a startup. Let them go join a big company and be a bureaucrat. Startups are about people who are fearless. You have to be. And then warn everyone before you hire them. The greatest people will come in the door. You will want to be selling the heck out of them. Stop first and say, are you aware this could fail? Are you aware we have no guarantees? Are you aware that we will probably change our mind 3 times on the business before we figure out how to make money? And if they look frightened, don't hire them. Because sure as God made little apples, sooner or later the crunch will come and they will be frightened and they will leave or panic and you'll be back hiring. Don't do it. Once you have a product, the whole company has to do this pivot. It has to pivot from being this obsessive, self-assured company, I know, running out the door, to the exact reverse. Total pragmatism, listen to the customers, be prepared to change, be the opposite of obsessive. Constantly listen. Figure out where the money is. You know, don't be completely idealistic. Even Mac went through this transition. I was talking before this talk about how if it hadn't been for the LaserJet and Adobe, Mac wouldn't have made it to where they are today. It was originally visionary, but it was WYSIWYG printing that carried Mac through to the point where they sort of could live to where they needed to be. And when you do hire, don't hire until you're desperate. The worst, in this stage of a startup, you have something called the runway, and the VCs are no longer willing to pay you money until you prove you can make sales. Every single dollar going out the door is that much less time to figure out how to make the sales and how to sell and how to correct the product. You should not be hiring expensive people. You should not be hiring people who need a lot of income. You should not be hiring people if you don't have to. Basically, this is where I've seen more startups fail than almost any other place other than the wrong people, wrong team. As the startups get to this point, they go, oh, we have a product. We're going to build staff. We're going to have marketing. We're going to have sales. We're going to have support. We're going to have this. They hire all these people. Very bad idea. The next thing they know, they're spending an extra $400,000 a month. They burn $5 million. The VCs say, hey, you just spent $5 million. You've only made $1 million in sales. Don't go there. You want at least 2 years of runway from the time you launch. And spend accordingly. It will seem almost impossible, but that's what you got to do. And when you do hire, make bets. Hire people for whom the job is a step up. Once in a while, there's a company that proves me wrong. Salesforce does the other way around. They tend to hire very senior people into roles. But 99% of the time when you're doing a startup, hire people for whom the role is a big promotion. Make a bet on them. Figure out that they have the moxie, the intelligence, the initiative, the drive, and the willingness to keep their hands and feet dirty at all times doing the work that needs to be done, and hire them and no one else. Because for them, you know, it's a big bet. They will do everything to make this work out. It's a huge opportunity. You hire someone who's already had this job for 10 years in a row, they're just not hungry enough, they won't do the other nitty-gritty that needs to be done, and you will regret it tremendously. So that's my wit and wisdom on building companies.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.